I don't know if that answered your question fully, but
okay. One further touch on the first question, on selling my own records. Well, I mean, I got my first record on my second birthday in 1928, and I can still play it for you. But and I had hundreds before I started grade school. Now I've got, like, all except to Fred, we have records that we don't have any record of. And I hope the IRS someday has to look at all of Fred's data to prove. But what do I, in the way that you have to operate where you can't justify it, you pay on every penny that you sell them for? Is that the way, what it amounts to, with those of us that can't say how much money we have?
You can't justify it.
I'm sorry, please repeat the question.
When I sell my records now, and I cannot tell you what I paid for them, or when I bought them, sometime in the last 60 years, do I have to put all of that income in and pay, I have nothing to deduct because I don't know what I paid for them, or if I did.
I would use reasonable, in the circumstances, I would search my memory, putting myself in your position, I would search my memory, try to estimate what I paid for them originally, whether they be 25 cents or 10 cents or 75 cents or $1 or $5. I certainly wouldn't put down $25 a record.
No.
I would reasonably estimate what my value was. It's true, if questioned, I may be hard-pressed to support it.
Yeah.
The government will allow you something. I used an extreme example in my talk that they can take the position of saying it was a gift, you have no receipts, no canceled checks, we're allowing a zero basis, therefore you pay the taxes on the entire amount. But in reality, that doesn't usually happen. Most of the time, they will allow a reasonable cost basis.
And that would be under filed under capital gains rather than as regular income?
In your case, assuming the same scenario about the time period held and so forth, yes, that would be filed under capital gains. But today, we have no longer a capital gains tax. That may change again. But yes, I would report on Schedule D, which winds up to be ordinary income and paid at a top 28%.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to elaborate on that, if I may. Because this comes up a lot as I'm an appraiser in the field. What I will do frequently, I just did a collection which was accumulated between 1950 and 1988 and included a lot of private issues. These are all LPs and there were private issues and the like in the collection and some scarce records and some ordinary records. In certain instances, I have actually gone back to the newspapers and Xeroxed out over a period of years the prices as advertised in the newspapers for Sam Goody's records or whatever, and use that as the market value in the area. In the case of a collection which is used records, which are still in print as new records, I have actually gone to local record stores and bought analogous records and kept the receipt, thrown the record, the discs away, or given them to the estate if there was time to do that, and use that receipt to show what the market is in that area for similar used records. Then the question only becomes, is the record I bought representative of the rest of the records in the collection? But it does show the IRS, here were the local conditions at the time.
Martin, before you do, let me, no, just one sentence. One of the questions that, sorry, one of the questions someone said to me this morning, you look good standing there, Martin. One of the questions that came up earlier is, how can I make the institution honor the contract in terms? In my opinion, representing one interested institution, your best lever is the desire of that institution to either keep or develop, if it doesn't have it, a good name, and two, to continue receiving gifts from other collectors. If you have reached an agreement with Yale, with Maryland, etc., and it was formally agreed to, and they are violating the terms of that agreement, the best lever you have to make them honor the agreement, or your estate has to make them honor that agreement, is to go to them and say, look, I'm not going to get any money out of this, and my estate If I do, I'm going to run into tax problems, I know that. But I'm going to let every damn collector that I know of, that I can get to, know what Yale University does with its stated gifts and commitments. They'll probably do their damnedest to honor your terms of contract. Okay, sorry, Mark.
Steve, did I really understand you to say that it is against the law for the institution to which a gift is being given to pay for the appraisal?
Absolutely. It's not the law, it's the tax regulation.
You get no deduction if the appraisal is paid for by the...
Is that also true in
Canada? No, there's a qualifier. If the appraisal is over $5,000.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Is that also true in Canada, does anybody know? Or is the National Library exempt from that?
I have never done a Canadian appraisal, I don't know.
Jerry? If Jerry is here, it'd be wonderful.
The Library of Congress used to do appraisals until the tax law regulations were changed in this country, too.
I've never really had to face this, aside from when I was at the National Library, but I know where I am now in a university setting. I'm allowed in the library myself to do an evaluation up to $2,000 worth of value. Over that, an outside appraiser has to do the appraisal.
But that's not, you don't know if that's law or if that's simply practice in your university.
In the province of Quebec, at least, that's perfectly legal. It's not our internal practice. I think any institution can do an internal evaluation up to that amount as long as you can justify it. I usually use price guides, you know, when I'm doing it so that I can show an outside person that it's not just out of my head. Mm-hmm. But I am not allowed to do over $2,000 worth. It saves a lot of hassle and expense in the smaller gifts, which are not really worth engaging an outside appraiser for because of the expense of the appraisal.
Kathleen, do you know what the situation is? Kathleen is at the National Archives in Ottawa.
I'm only aware, I'm not sure of whether it's in the law or not. I just know in our institution, archivists such as myself can make appraisals up to a certain amount of money. I think it's $5,000 for us. And at the National Archives, we have a appraisal board which is paid by the National Archives, but they consider themselves distinct from us. So they independently assess a collection, and that is how the amount is reached at. But I don't know whether it's law or not.
The reason for the change in the U.S. regulations was to avoid the conflict of interest or the appearance of conflict of interest between the donor, the receiving organization, and the donor, because there was a situation with film where one institution was saying, well, we'll give you a minimum of 15 cents per foot for anything you donate to us, and another one would say, we'll give you 17 cents. And there was an auction taking place among institutions at one point along these lines, and it had nothing to do with the value of the material. At the same time, the Library of Congress, should I mention this? I should mention this.
Sure, why not?
Was the only institution in the country that was permitted to do its own in-house evaluations. And so they were receiving manuscripts by promising things to authors.
No promise.
Oh, excuse me.
No. Go ahead, sorry. No promises up front.
There were arrangements inferred.
Not with records.
I think we can pass on to the next question.
Yes, sir.
This may get us right back there.
I'm sorry, your name, please?
Christine Hoffman from Rodgers and Hammerstein Archive. Sure. Steve, I've heard you talk about appraisals and appraising, I think in MLA context before. And if I remember correctly, I don't remember the details, but you talked a little bit about how you become certified as an appraiser and why in the world you would want to do that as a business. And it seems as though there was a downside, which I didn't hear you mention today, and I remember it as being interesting, and if I came in late and missed it, I'm sorry, but if you didn't talk about it, could you mention it again?
No, I prefer to avoid even thinking about that.
Uh-huh.
Yes. There is something in here which says, and I'm not going to find it now that I'm looking for it. What I'm looking for is the penalties for a fraudulent or otherwise nasty appraisal, where the appraiser himself a penalties. Somebody can read. Oh, you've got one. An appraiser who falsely or fraudulently overstates the value of property described in a qualified appraisal or an appraisal summary that the appraiser has signed may be subject to a civil penalty for aiding and abetting an understatement of tax liability and may have his or her appraisals disregarded, and I might add, may no longer be qualified to do appraisals. Furthermore, they then come back to the client and say, aha, and so you get nailed for the difference between the reappraisal by presumably a more qualified appraiser and the figure you have come up with, and the client is charged penalties on top of that. I hope that makes everybody happy.
Hi. Peter Bergman, formerly of Rodgers and Hammerstein. Just to throw a little historical perspective, going back about 21 years when I first went to work at Rodgers and Ham, we had a lot of collections that had just been donated to the collection, which were, by implication, to be kept intact. With a collection that large, it became virtually impossible. I think there were still some small pockets of things, especially very specialized collections like the Lawrence and Lee collection of radio transcriptions from the 40s and 50s. But within a collection of general LPs, like the collection of Alphonse Giorizzo, these were dispersed into the collection, and ultimately in various sales that the library has had over the years to raise money for the research collections, a lot of these records did turn up in the for sale bins. I think the green sleeves that were stamped from the collection of Alphonse Giorizzo were kept together in the collection. So at least the green sleeves are still there. But if you're considering giving your collection to an institution, one of the most important things to think about is what will that collection be used for, how will it be used, and will it be kept intact? And from a collector's point of view, I know, Steve, you said you didn't think your collection was worth a lot financially, but for its information and for its comprehension, it may well be worth a great deal. And for example, if I wish I did, but if I had a collection of pre-World War II Kurt Weill recordings from Germany of live performances, I wouldn't give them to a library, I would give them to the Kurt Weill Foundation, someplace that would be able to utilize them in a group as a collection, keep them identified as such, and it's something you have to look around, I think, a lot these days to find an institution that will honor the intent and the integrity of the collection. It's not easy anymore, but it can still be done.
Would any of my colleagues from institutions care to respond to that?
Please.
Mark.
Holly.
Holly Makovic from Cambridge.
I'm sorry, your name again? I'm sorry.
Holly Makovic. Yeah, that's just a very important point, and I've seen a lot of institutions lose track of their gifts. They don't know who donated something. They don't know when. They never inventoried even a quick hand list of any one gift. Sometimes decades later, we all regret that. And I think that from the donor's point of view, if you're worried about keeping something intact, that might not physically be possible for an institution to accommodate, but at the very least, the intellectual content of what that gift was all about is important. An inventory and a list, I think, is something that you should insist upon for yourselves, and also the institutions in the future will be glad that they had to spend the time preparing that kind of thing, at the very least. That was just my remark.
I'm Morgan Cundiff from... excuse me.
Steve wanted to add something to that, if you want more.
There is another kind of institutional collection, and that is the special collection where the gift of a donor is kept intact, or at least is tied together through the computer, as an artifact of that given person, rather than for the content of the material. The University of Wyoming has an enormous group of collections of showbiz folk and the like, where the same records, the same discs will turn up in a number of collections, but this was the collection that so-and-so accumulated as a boy or girl, and these were the records that influenced him, that he kept with him into his old age or whatever, and this is the same record turning up in so-and-so's other person's collection, which had the similar effect. That is another possibility. However, I do suggest that you at least get into who's who before you consider that kind of a donation.
Hopefully an institution will be honest enough, if you say you want the collection to be retained as a unit, to not only tell you no, if that's what their intention is, but hopefully to give you some understanding of what the commitments and problems are in your request. You are, unless the institution is wealthy enough, and there are very few sound collections in this country, archival collections that are wealthy enough to have a full catalog of its collections. If the collection is maintained as a unit, presuming it's commercial material, it probably, with the single aspect of the way that you have structured the collection, and presuming that's what you've asked for, will be unavailable to the average user, because they're not, with the financial support we have, are probably not going to be able to adequately catalog that collection in the foreseeable future. Now, if you're willing to assist us in the financial support to undertake that cataloging to make the material available to someone who wants to use it in a way different than you conceived of it, I would suspect that most of the institutions out there who collect recordings would certainly be willing to talk about it with you, to discuss it, and to explore it. But there are many levels of why the institution does not, in many cases, cannot maintain the unity which you have put into that collection. Back to you, Morgan, shortly. Go ahead.
If your collection goes to the institution with your own catalog, no matter how it's set up, and we'll hear more about that in the course of this meeting, the institution may not have a catalog which integrates with the rest of its cataloging procedures, but it does have a finding aid to find its way around your collection. That may be a critical factor in an institution deciding whether to keep the collection intact or to break it up. So there's something to be said for all us computer squirrels.
Morgan.
Morgan Cundiff from the University of Maryland. First, I just want to say I think this has been an excellent discussion and long overdue within this group. It's been a real benefit to me, so I appreciate the things that have been said. Most of what's been said, though, has been kind of the cold and negative and almost paranoid side of all this, and I know it's all very real and based upon facts and so forth, but just to be more positive for a second, having the relationship as a donor with a collection can be extremely satisfying. It can work out very well for both parties. And knowing that your baby is going to live on can really work out very well for you. But I think the key is to pick the right institution. We've been talking a lot in generalities today. Institutions this and institutions that, but speaking from the standpoint as an institutional curator, we all know that every single situation is really unique, and so I offer a couple of small points just as advice from the point of view of our side of the fence from the inside the institution. Like anything else, it's a two-way street. It's if the best deal is going to be a good deal for both parties, for both the institution and the donor. And that's the kind of situation you're really looking for, where there's genuinely something in it for both, because that's the one where the cooperation is going to be the highest and the result is going to be the best. And I would urge you to be reasonable and flexible yourself going in. Collectors like to tell horror stories about curators and institutions and so forth that have committed awful blasphemies and so forth in terms of collections, but curators can tell those kind of stories about collectors just as well. Some people have come in with their collections and are so demanding that they're quite literally more trouble to deal with than their collection is worth. And, you know, I'd caution you to avoid that, to be sensitive to the fact that the institution has things they can do and things they can't do, and to go in and be willing to be flexible, to work with them as you go. A couple of specific points, and just to underline that things are very negotiable. It's dangerous to generalize because every situation is unique, or at least the ones that I've been a part of. Institutions have some things they can do, some things they can't do. But if they value your collection, they can be very flexible and very creative in how the whole arrangement is made. And I think just to underline what Jerry was saying, basically, what an institution wants or what they don't want is they don't want a legal problem and they don't want a publicity problem. You know, those are the two bad things. You can't do anything to us financially as a rule. But those are the two bad things that you're trying to avoid, and be sensitive to that. And if you go in threatening about the story that's going to be in the New York Times, if we don't do all the things that you think is right, you know, the institution's going to shy away from that kind of an approach, and you should be sensitive to that. Some of the particular things that are negotiable that I've seen happen at our institution that you might want to make part of your deal is that an exhibit can be given. You know, it will be a very satisfying thing to you to go through the exhibit process, to do a major one of high quality that will bring the publicity to it, that will give it the exposure, make people aware of it, and so forth. And that can be written into the contract, that an exhibit will be given within a certain period of time. Likewise, that a catalog or a finding aid will be created and possibly even published and distributed of your collection. For you personally, another thing is that you can have copies made on demand. You know, a lot of people hate to give their stuff up, obviously, but if they can have copies of items when they need them, that can work out well. And another point is what your role will be once you have given the collection and as you enter retirement or whatever point you're at, but that you're going to maintain, if you want to maintain some kind of continuing role with the collection, and that's a real two-edged sword there. Some of the horror stories that curators can tell are that the person continued to be very demanding and, you know, a pain in the neck forever, and you want to avoid that, obviously. People don't, we all have a lot of things to do, and all of our attention cannot be to one donor. On the other hand, the way it's always worked out in my experience is that we have very much appreciated the donor's continuing involvement, especially with just identifying the collection. The donor is the one person who can help you catalog it better than anyone else. And as far as selecting an institution, just a little bit of consumer advice. One of the things you can do is go to the institution and request a list of other donors that they have dealt with in similar situations. And they may want to give that to you, and they may not. I'm sure they're prerogative. We are very willing to. We give a list of names that we've dealt with on a similar basis, and we say, go to those people and talk and get their reaction to how we have treated them and how we have treated the materials, how we've kept our part of the bargain. I think that could be extremely revealing for you. Visit the institution and see what they're doing. See how they're handling similar collections. You know, if things are in chaos and a mess, you know, that tells you something. Discuss in great detail how your collection really will complement what is already there, because that's what is going to enhance its value to the collection. Okay. And just one last point, and Jerry will get mad at me for saying this, but I'll throw it out anyway.
No, I
won't. And very frankly, how will your collection rate in terms of what that institution already has? If you go to the Library of Congress, we keep using them, but any prestigious large collection, you know, it can be like bringing coals to Newcastle. And the fact is that in terms of their priorities, you're not really going to rate.
Oh.
That's a low shot.
But okay, go ahead. I'm not angry, though.
I think it's something to consider. Okay, I'll stop there.
Once again, hopefully we will be honest enough with you, and if we're not honest enough with you as a donor, and that this goes for not only the Library of Congress, but Maryland, Yale, Wesleyan, I see lined up, to tell you where your collection rates, what our needs and what our priorities are. One of the reasons you might come to one of us is because of the track record we have. One of the reasons you might avoid us is because of the track record we have. And it's, as the donor, it is your choice. And the more information I can tell you about what the institution is and what its needs and priorities and what its track record is, the better you're going to be able to make an intelligent decision.
You might also want to discuss this with the appraiser, who has a broad experience in this and will often find homes for collections that you might not be able to place otherwise.
We're going to have to limit it to the next two people. I would like to ask, if we can, go ahead after you two, to see if the panel has any closing comments they want to make. Richard?
Richard Warren. I'd like to slice the question of gifts a slightly different way to expand a little bit, and that is the question of whether what you collect may be unique, maybe live recordings, unique acetates, yes, or tapes, transcriptions, things like that, which probably, at least in the form you have them, don't exist anywhere else. That's a kind of collection that's another kind of double-edged sword. You can be offering an institution something which it certainly will not have other copies of in that case. The other edge of the sword, though, is that if they're acetates or audio tapes, it would be, in a sense, ridiculous for the institution to promise you that it would keep them forever, because they won't last forever. So you want to think about that and go into the question with a prospective donee of, well, what can be done realistically about that, so that nobody's making impossible statements with collections of commercial recordings. I don't think I, in my own collection, have anything that's unique. So I don't tend to think to worry about looking for a home for it in terms of insisting that any recipient keep everything intact. In professionally, what I do is to make a list of every collection that comes in, so that we can tell, for relatively speaking, forever, what a given person did donate. I believe I've heard people say that many institutions, other institutions, do that. And I sense in talking to colleagues and in my own institution that there's a definite bias toward accepting collections which have no strings attached. This is an administrative thing. Okay. You want to go for the fewest conditions, because those are the things that are going to cause trouble later on for everybody. And nobody wants people to be unhappy, particularly now in the future, to get the kinds of things Morgan was talking about and repercussions. A few more things.
Jim Farrington from Wesleyan University. Just want to touch a little bit on something that Holly brought up and Morgan touched on. When I came to Wesleyan 3 years ago, I inherited this collection of unique field recordings, many of which we don't know who donated, when, what the hell's on the tape, we have no idea. But we've got these things, and they are valuable and unique in their own way. So if you have donated in the past to somewhere, it doesn't hurt to check back and see what they've done with it. I know in our case, I would love it if some donor came back to me and says, hey, whatever happened to those tapes that I donated back in the 50s of Navajo music or whatever music that they donated? Because then I would say, somebody, I know who this person is, I can get their address. A lot of the address files that I have are decades out of date and that kind of thing. So if you have donated, contact the place and see what they've done. I mean, heeding Morgan's words, you don't need to contact them every afternoon at 3 o'clock to do that. But every once in a while, it doesn't hurt to go back.
Do we have time for a very brief wrap-up,
yeah,
or do we need to end?
Yeah, 1 minute for each one of you.
I'm just going to take less than a couple of seconds because I'm looking forward to hearing about the Beach Boys. I just think this is a long overdue topic. I'm glad we did it. I think the group here realizes it. Maybe we can do a follow-up in another year or two on that.
As I said in closing this morning, think out what you want to do, know what you want to do, then become informed and educated as to the right way to do it, and take the necessary steps, but just know what you're doing before you do it.
The only thing I would add would be to reinforce several points that Morgan made. Know what you want for your collection. Know what your collection is, and if possible, know the strengths and weaknesses of the potential institution you're talking with, or where you think you want it to go. And anything is negotiable. Things cost money, and the institution may have to say, in order to honor what you're asking, we're going to either have to find the funds elsewhere, or we're going to have to ask for your assistance. There's none of us that are wealthy enough to agree to what I think are reasonable requests that we've heard talked about back and forth here. And hopefully, I and my colleagues will be honest enough with you to say, I can't afford what you're talking about. I cannot deliver on what you're asking me to agree to. And therefore, I cannot reach an agreement with you. Thank you very much. Particularly want to thank Craig Reeves. He is the non-ARSC member here. I especially appreciate your coming in. And hope you have a chance to meet with us this evening. You'll be on the pub crawl with us. And if you have a chance, you might corner him for a little more free legal advice, etc.
Thank you.